But I think it's very true to say that we live a very sort of self-absorbed age. I've got a little limerick to read you. It's not one that I wrote, but it's not bad. It goes like this. There was once a nymph named Narcissus who thought himself very delicious. So he stared like a fool at his face in a pool, and his folly today is still with us. John Stott quotes an advert in a psychology magazine, which reads like this. I love me. I'm not conceited. I'm just a good friend to myself. Amazing, isn't it, the things that people come up with. I read about a story about a professor who used to receive books to review, and some of the books were very boring. And so he came up with a very clever ruse, which was rather naughty, frankly, but I think professors do this sort of thing. He took the books that he didn't like and were very boring, and he would send them to some of his professor friends anonymously, pretending that they were really coming from the author. And he would write on the author's behalf and say something along the lines of, I hope that you approve of the references I've used to your name in this book. Thanks, the author. And he would send them. And of course, it was all working on the idea that these people who received these books would be furiously looking through the pages to find reference to their name in this book. You know, it might be a long book, 500 pages, but they'll go through the whole book trying to find that one reference to their name somewhere. All in vain, of course. But it all worked on the basis that people, he knew that people, and maybe that's us this morning as well, maybe we can also identify with this mythological figure, Narcissus, and recognise that we too can be very sort of caught up with ourselves. And, you know, I can put my hand up and say, yes, okay, I can do that too. And if you're not sure, and if you're somebody who's regularly on the internet, just ask yourself this question. Have you ever Googled your own name? Ever Googled your own name? Well, I think it says something, and I confess again, I have done that. So, yes. Well, today, we're continuing in our series in Mark's Gospel. And we've so far gone up to Mark chapter 10, and we're now at verse 32, going through to verse 45, which David read for us earlier on. And today we come to two figures that come right into the spotlight. Their names are James and John. Very common names. They might be names that you have in your own family. James and John, good names. But today, these good names are not really put in a very good light, these James and John. And Jesus is making his way up to Jerusalem, very steadily, but very earnestly. He's going towards Jerusalem. And it's now, as Jesus is telling all the disciples, you know, I'm going to go up to Jerusalem, I'm going to be killed, I'm going to be persecuted up in Jerusalem, and on the third day I'm going to rise again. It's then that these two disciples of Jesus, who were part of the sort of the inner circle, part of the inner three disciples, take as their cue to make an incredible request of Jesus that they might get pole position in his kingdom when he comes into his glory. And possibly we raise our eyebrows at James and John and think, you know, how on earth could they do that at such a moment? But you know, Mark, who writes this gospel, is a master at juxtaposing things, putting his stories in such a way that he really draws out the thing that we're supposed to get from it. It's a real irony, isn't it, that at such a moment, James and John could make such a request of Jesus. We've got some very good friends whose names are Jane and Arthur, but we often refer to them simply by the name of Arthur. We call them the Arthurs. The Arthurs. We're going to go to lunch at the Arthurs. And today I want to lump James and John together and call them the Jameses. The Jameses. And you know, we have this notion, don't we, in our day and age, a phrase we use, of keeping up with the Joneses. You've heard that phrase? Keeping up with the Joneses. Well, today, it's not maybe so much a case of keeping up with the Joneses, but keeping up with the Jameses. And I think we'll be able to identify with them. These people, their self-preoccupation was of a really phenomenal level. It had come to such a height. Verse 41 reads this. When the ten heard about this, of course, the ten remaining disciples, they became indignant with James and John. Now, why were the other 10 really cross with James and John? Well, I suggest it's not because they had some sort of righteousness, some righteous anger. I think it was simply because James and John had thought of it before they did. They'd got to the head of the queue. They'd queue jumped. And so they were furious. They're hopping mad. Well, this morning I've got a very simple structure. And whether you are a believer, whether you're not a believer, whether you're kind of keeping up with the Joneses or just keeping up with the Jameses, I think we have something this morning. And I want to suggest that self-absorption is something we all struggle with. And today we're going to come and look at the cross of Christ. Our passage, in a sense, has two parts to it. We have the early part where we see James and John, and we have the end part where we see Jesus giving us a mission statement. There at verse 45, the very last verse of the section we read. And this really is a classical kind of juxtaposing of things that you think just could never fit together. Jesus there says, "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many." And this morning, I want to look at two things, two viewpoints about the cross of Christ, the work of Christ. And the first is for those who struggle too much with the cross of Christ. And the second is those who struggle too little with the cross of Christ. And you'll be able to see which category you fall into, because I guess we fall one of two ways this morning. So number one, where people struggle too much with the cross of Christ. Now this might be you this morning, I don't know. You'll have to judge that yourself. Maybe you've come here this morning and to you the cross really doesn't make an awful lot of sense. It seems strange. Maybe very backward. Something that's classical about religion. That in some ways religion is very primitive. And so you look at the cross and you look at all this talk about the shedding of blood and all that sort of thing and sacrifice. And you think, well, I don't get it. This is really strange. Why do Christians talk about these sorts of things? I mean, are they morbid? Or is it a case of trying to appease some fearful, angry God that is about to sort of throw down a thunderbolt and to strike us in a moment of his sort of fiendish and feverish anger towards mankind? Is that what the cross is all about? I really don't understand it. It might be that that's something of how you feel this morning. Maybe you feel, well, you know, the cross is very depressing. You know, there's too many things already in life that are depressing. So why do Christians need to have this cross, this death thing? You know, there's already too much that is down and depressing. Why can't we be a bit more upbeat, a bit more refined, a bit more sophisticated in faith? Well, we have here a mission statement of Jesus. That's what this is. He says that I have come to give my life as a ransom for many. This is Jesus explaining why he came. And it might be that you say to yourself, well, okay, so Jesus apparently has come to ransom us, to forgive us. But why couldn't Jesus just take a more sensible route? After all, did not God in the beginning say, let there be light? Did he not say, let there be vegetation, let there be an expanse to separate the sky from the earth? Didn't he say all these things, and they all just happened? In 6 days, God put in place the whole universe. And then he stood back and said, this is good. What I have made is good. So why could not God simply say, as he looks at what is bad, well, let there be forgiveness. Let there be this huge, eternal, sort of divine rug in which I sweep all the sins of the world underneath this divine, eternal rug so that it is out of my sight. Could not God just do that and be done with it? And then we don't have to have all this mention of the cross and the taking of the Lord's Supper, the bread for his body, the wine for his blood. Why all this focus? It's just nonsensical. Well, to put it in a nutshell, we have this verse where Jesus is telling us that he is going to die. And it's very contrary. It's almost counterintuitive to everything we know in this life. Because we concentrate, I think pretty well to a T, about life, don't we? We're all thinking about our lives and what we're going to achieve, what we're going to accomplish, what we're going to do in our lives in the coming months and years. But Jesus completely turns it the other way around. He says, you know, my life is one thing, but my life is really leading up to my death. We do it the other way. We maximize our lives and we minimize our demise, our death. But Jesus does it the other way round. I want to make a couple of sort of observations. And the first observation is to do with Mark's gospel. Mark in his gospel writes 16 chapters. It's not a particularly long gospel. The other gospels are all longer. But his gospel divides very neatly in two halves. And in fact, we've just gone past the sort of the turning point of the gospel. And the first 8 chapters are all to do with Jesus as the Messiah. And if you were here probably a month ago, you would have come to that passage where Peter recognizes that Jesus is in fact the Messiah. It's like a huge penny drops in his head. And Jesus says, you know, you didn't figure that out. God revealed that to you. God made you suddenly realize that I am the Messiah. I am the one of the Old Testament who has been spoken about all the way through the Old Testament. You know, one of the first events in Mark's gospel, in fact, the first one of Jesus' ministry, is his baptism. There he goes to the Jordan, gets baptized by John the Baptist. And Jesus says, you know, we need to fulfill this for all, to fulfill all righteousness. We need to do this. And then there's a voice that comes out of heaven saying, this is my son. With him I am well pleased. And you know, that scripture there, that voice from heaven, was really a sort of a sticking together, a gluing together of two Old Testament passages. One in Psalm 2 and one in Isaiah 42. And there's two things there. The first is that this is my son. And Psalm 2 picks that one up. And they would have understood that reference to the son. And that son there is the one who is the Messiah. But then he goes on to talk about the fact that this son, this is now in Isaiah 42, is not only a son, he's not only a Messiah, a sort of anointed one, but he's also a servant, a suffering servant. This is the theme that gets picked up in Isaiah 42. And so there really are two revelations that we need to understand. The first is that Jesus is the Christ, he's the Messiah. And Peter and the disciples get that at towards the end of chapter 8. But immediately they've got it, Jesus then starts to tell them something that he's going to tell them at least 3 times. And that is, it comes there in Mark 8 and verse 31. Let me read it to you. Says this, he then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests and teachers of the law, that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. And he does that 3 times over. 3 times he starts to tell this. In chapter 8, chapter 9, and now in chapter 10, Jesus is telling them again, you know, I'm going to Jerusalem, going to the cross, where I am going to die as a ransom for many. So the whole second half of the book of Mark is all about this revelation, not that Jesus is Messiah now, but the fact that he is the suffering servant, that he is going to be one who not only rules and reigns as a king, but he's also going to be somebody who is going to be suffering. And that is something that is totally, totally unheard of for them, totally foreign. It was one thing to understand he was Messiah, it's entirely another to realize that this Messiah is actually going to suffer. It seems crazy. They could understand him wearing a crown and being in glory. They could understand the triumphal entry, going up to Jerusalem and getting all the sort of adoration of the crowd. But the idea of suffering on a cross was something totally that they could not get their heads around. So here at the cross, we understand that he is going to give his life as a ransom. Now, what is a ransom? Well, a ransom is something which would have been well understood in those days. It was something to do with war. In war, if they caught one of your generals or one of your colonels, they would say quite often to the people, if you want him back, you've got to pay us a ransom. Pay us a ransom. Or alternatively, it was used in the slave market. If somebody was a slave and they wanted to be made free, then you had to pay a ransom for that slave to get freedom. And so Jesus is saying that his life is going to take the form of a ransom, a payment. And that includes the idea of exchange. Money in exchange for you, for your life. You know, that's what's going on, isn't it? With all these pirates, this modern day piracy that's going on. All these vessels getting snatched and big sums of money being extracted from the owners of the vessels. It's the same idea, isn't it? Ransom in exchange for your lives, for your cargo, for your boat. We want money. And not a little bit of money. We want a lot of money. And so Jesus was making a ransom payment in exchange for us. It's a lovely thing. A ransom for many. That little word for is the Greek word anti, which we have in our language. We talk about wearing antiperspirant. And it can either be translated against, you're anti-something, I'm not for this, I'm against it. Or it's something instead of. It means that it gets translated instead of. So this is in a ransom instead of many. That's why the cross is so central. It's why churches have a crucifix put up outside their buildings and that sort of thing. It's why some Christians wear a little cross around their neck or something like that. Very central. So at three different levels, Jesus' death is not actually nonsensical. It's not meant to be offensive, but it's something that helps us to see, on the one hand, yes, the gravity of sin. Sin isn't something that God can just click his fingers and say, well, let's just ignore it, let's put it under the carpet because it doesn't matter. It shows us the gravity, the severity of sin. It also shows us the dignity and the value of each one of us. It's us that Jesus is substituting himself for. It's you. It's me. It's every single one of us. On our behalf, he is saying, it's going to be me instead of you. I'm going to take your place on the cross. The punishment for your sin, you should have borne it yourself. I mean, a man, a woman should be responsible for their sins, but I am going to take it for you. I'm going to take it off you. The third thing is that, you know, here we appreciate the sacrifice of the Son of God. It was no small thing that Jesus was doing as he hung there in agony on the cross. Well, that is the first category. The second is this. Not a case of people struggling too much with the cross, but people struggling too little with the cross. You see, if we truly understand the cross, then it will change us. If I understand the cross, then my life will never be the same again. Now, the reality is that doesn't happen just like that. You know, change for all of us happens a little at a time, doesn't it? I mean, it's very, very rarely that we suddenly have an incredible sea change. Occasionally it happens, doesn't it? You see somebody, think they're just totally different. But it usually happens a little at a time. Change works itself into us a bit at a time. And it's the same with the cross of Christ. It slowly challenges us and it slowly changes us. And the disciples were certainly no different. It's interesting, we note, when we look at the disciples, how they respond to Jesus telling them about the fact that he's actually going to be suffering in this second half of the gospel, in the second part of his life. He's going to be suffering. And it's interesting to see how the disciples respond to that. The first time, Peter responds to it. Peter's just said, you are the Christ. You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And he said, okay, fine, now I'm going to Jerusalem, I'm going to die. And what does Peter do? He doesn't say, oh, okay, Lord, I'm learning something new here. This is very fascinating. I didn't expect you to say that. Instead, he rebukes him and says, no, Lord, no way. That's never going to happen to you. And Jesus says to him, Satan, get behind me. You don't have in mind the things of God. You have in mind things of man. You think like men do. But I am on a different agenda. And then the second time, chapter 9, where Jesus says exactly the same thing, I'm going up Jerusalem, I'm going to die, and all of that. Then the disciples, amazingly, they have a little debate. They have a little debate on the road after Jesus said this, and they say, I wonder who's the greatest amongst us. Isn't that amazing? Jesus just said, I'm going to be suffering. I'm going to be mocked. I'm going to be killed up in Jerusalem. And the disciples totally don't get it. It goes right over their heads, and they start discussing, you know, I'm pretty good. I think I'm the greatest. I think I'm the number one disciple. And they all start bickering with each other. And then Jesus says to them, what were you discussing on the road then? You know, back there. Of course, Jesus knows precisely what they were discussing, but he kind of tries to draw it out a little bit. And they say, kind of nothing. They keep shtuck, of course, just like little children. And then the final time, as we have in our passage today in Mark 10, we've got these two vying for first and second place in the kingdom. They want to be, if you like, prime minister on your right hand and chancellor of exchequer on your left. Isn't it amazing? It's a very slow process to get the idea of the cross and suffering and everything that it's achieving, the very purposes of God, to actually weave that into our thinking is something very difficult. You know, we're told in Romans that we should no longer be conformed to the pattern of this world, but that we should be transformed by the renewing of our minds. It's a process, isn't it? A renewing of our minds. And what I want to suggest as I kind of bring to a conclusion is that our minds shouldn't be conformed. We shouldn't have conformity, but we should have cruciformity. Now, I don't know if you know what I mean. Cruciformity. It's the word for the cross. Crucify, cruciformity. Our lives should become progressively cross-shaped. The cross and everything that was going on at the cross, all the transaction going on at the cross, should begin to change our lives. I want to give you three ways, three sort of choices that are going to get presented to us as we consider, as we stand back and look at that cross, ponder what was going on there. It's going to change us. And they are three choices, three challenges. In a sense, it's like 3 degrees by which our life may get slowly pared down into the right sort of shape. I've drawn these out of John Stott's classic book, The Cross of Christ. It's a wonderful book to read. And the first is this choice of sacrifice or ambition. Now, it's very obvious that the Jameses here were out for ambition. They were definitely go-getters. They saw their little opportunity, although it was a terribly wrong time to do it, and they nipped in there. Maybe they thought, Jesus is getting a bit serious about this dying stuff. This has got to be our time. We better strike while we've got a little window of opportunity. Maybe they're real opportunists. And they had a very ambitious spirit. It's interesting to read that in Matthew's Gospel we have a parallel account. And there we read that it was actually her mother that was kind of a bit in the driving seat here. I mean, there was obviously a crowd of people. There were disciples, the 12 disciples, and then there were some various ladies that were sort of helping and supporting, the sort of the support team for Jesus. And James and John's mother, Salome, was there. And we believe that she was involved in some way with egging the two on and bringing her two sons, always thinking about the best for her sons, bringing them before Jesus and encouraging them to ask this incredible request. Well, they didn't exactly get it, and Jesus tried to explain to them they don't really know what they are asking for. I don't know whether you've ever asked a prayer and God has said no, you have not got the prayer you asked. And later, further down the line, as you've grown older, as you've matured in the Lord, you've understood and thought, well, I'm kind of glad that God never answered that prayer. Maybe you looked at somebody and you thought, I really fancy that person. But somehow it never worked out for you. It never came together, never gelled. Perhaps they didn't like you and all your little advances to that person kind of like fell on deaf ears, I don't know. But later down the line, maybe they got married and then you saw the way they turned out. You thought, man, I'm glad. I'm so glad that I did not marry this person. I can think back to my own life, but that's another story and I'm not going there this morning. Don't press me on the issue. But, you know, we can have such wrong ambitions, and thank God that he will confront us and say, you do not know what you are asking, and I am not going to be answering that prayer. In Ephesians 5, we read this from the pen of Paul writing to the Ephesians. He says, be imitators of God, therefore, as dearly loved children, and live a life of love, just as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us as a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. Jesus' life was one that we are to imitate, and it was a life of sacrifice. of giving up of himself. I mean, all of love, any kind of life-changing love, works through sacrifice when you think about it. When you roll it through, it can be worked through in various ways. For example, take parenthood. Parents have a choice. They could stand back from their children and say, I'm not sacrificing my life. Okay, I've got these kids. They're going to grow up, but I'm not going to sacrifice my life. I've got my own life to lead, you know. Who are these kids to take my life? But that's not the way we work. As parents, we normally pour our lives out into our children, don't we? At least for many, many years we do that. We put our lives very often on hold for our children. And it is a life-changing thing for them because it's a case of sacrificial love that we're doing. If we don't do that and we say, no, my life's my own, I'm keeping it, we don't pour it out into our kids, well, what happens? We get a very bad effect with our kids. They grow up resentful and hateful, and it's a very bad equation. Well, think about forgiveness. Inevitably, there's going to come a point in your life where somebody's going to do something to you. They might take your prized possession and drop it on the floor, and it'll smash. And you're going to think to yourself, how careless you were. That was my pride and joy. Maybe it was some plant in the garden, you know, and the boys were playing football. It was your pride and joy. Maybe it was that prized marrow that you've been growing for months, sort of watering it and putting in all the right manures and everything to get this prize marrow, and somehow the ball lands on it and it goes splat or something like that. You have a case of forgiveness there that is going to be required. Now you have a choice. Either you take the hit yourself, either you take, absorb the pain, or you exact it from the other side. And usually when you exact it from the other side, you don't give forgiveness. There's no loving forgiveness there. It kind of starts a circle of sort of retaliation. You start to show your dislike of that person for what they did, and then they respond to that dislike with some other dislike, and it goes round and round, and it's a terrible situation. So really, love that's going to change anything is a sacrificial love. You have to pay, you have to absorb the pain yourself. Sacrifice, then, or ambition is a choice. The second choice of cruciformity is service or power. The Jameses were after position, and that's what they wanted. But it's not good just to have position. You need power as well. You need position and power to go with it. And we all desire that. We want to have status, and we want to have recognition, but we also want to have influence with people. We want to be able to pull the strings, you know, call the shots, have people, you know, at our beck and call. Think to yourself, well, I've got 20, 30, 40 people that all report to me, you know. We like that sort of thing. And Jesus recognized it, and he said to them there in verse 42, the Gentiles, they do that. They lord it over them. But he goes on in verse 43, not so with you. This is not the way, lording it over people, calling all the shots. You're not supposed to live in this way. Greatness in the kingdom, instead, is different. Greatness in the kingdom is more about sharing power, maybe empowering other people. Maybe it's a giving of power. It's where we are able to humbly serve. And of course we get that in the mission statement of Jesus. Even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. And so what he's saying, he's working for the greatest to the least. If the great one is to serve, how much more you? If I, as the Master, as the Lord, as the Messiah, serve, can it be that you don't serve somehow? You know, I'm the Master, you're the servant. You should serve, not me, but I did serve, and so all the more so should you. The third choice, after sacrifice and service, is suffering. Suffering or comfort. We all hanker, don't we, after comfort. We all love comforts in this day and age of mod cons and little gadgets and everything. We have them all over the place to make our lives comfortable. We have coffee that you can just chuck in the cup, pour in the water, and it's done. Amazing, just like that. And so we like our comfort. It's really difficult to actually somehow get away from having to have our comforts at every level. But Jesus said these words to somebody. He said, you know, foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. Comfort wasn't exactly at the top of Jesus' agenda. There in the garden, he throws himself down on the ground and he says, "Not your will, not my will, but yours be done." He sweats drops of blood. It was so difficult and so serious suffering that he was going through. I wonder this morning whether you struggle too much with the cross. You think it just is nonsensical, it's just crazy, it doesn't make sense at all. But I would say to you, look, the cross is where a ransom was being paid. A big price was being paid, which was placed on your head. That means you're valuable. And that price was paid as an exchange. The cross makes every sense. On the other hand, it might be that you view the cross, the cross as essentially very sensical, very sensible. But you are still awaiting the follow-through. The follow-through of the cross in your life to change you. And it needs to change you in at least three ways. It means that you need to give up all these petty ambitions. You know, at the end of the day, you can be climbing the corporate ladder. And when you get to the top of the corporate ladder, what I can tell you now is that you're going to realize that actually, having spent all your life climbing to the top, your ladder was leaning against the wrong wall. That's the sad thing about climbing the ladder of ambition. The only ladder that you should be wanting to pay attention to is that ladder that Jacob had in the dream. When he was there at this place, Bethel, he lies down, he has a dream, he sees a ladder, angels descending and ascending. It was a reminder, a very important reminder, that there is a connection between God in heaven and earth down here. It's a vital, vital connection. And if you don't have that connection, if you don't believe in that connection, well, you might as well just go and get ambition and power and all the rest of it. But I can tell you that there is a ladder, and it's not a corporate ladder. So yes, we should choose sacrifice and not ambition. We should choose service and not power grabbing. We should choose suffering and not have an all-consuming focus on comfort as the way ahead. Well, let's pray that the cross of Christ might give us a true cruciformity by degrees, from one degree of glory to another. Amen.